If you interrupt me the way you do all the time and everybody else, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to call you on it, or I'm going to keep talking, or if it's an poignant, appropriate moment, then I'm going to go with it. But sometimes I may just be like, I'm going to finish my thought, because it is jarring, right? So, and I do it too. So we'll both hold each other accountable to, you know, we both get excited.
And now you know what the competition is going to be. This is Price Talks, and I'm the Price and Price Talks, Gord Price. When we started these podcasts, the idea was to let's bring in people to discuss the issues you'll find in price tags. You know, good urbanism stuff, land use, transportation, fun stuff. But it was also just to get to talk to interesting people, people I'd seen around or heard and thought, I could spend at least an hour just in conversation, no set agenda, with someone like Mark Boozy. Hey, Mark. Thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
You an interesting guy?
I think some would say that. Lots would say that. Some might say I'm annoying. Some might say I'm inspirational. But lots would say I'm interesting, at least, yeah.
All right. Let's play podcast ping pong.
Ping pong, okay.
I'll serve you a question. You serve back. Just quick stuff. Find out a little bit about each other.
Okay.
First, I serve the question every Vancouverite either asks or gets, where are you from?
Well, after my family moved when I was quite young from Manitoba, I spent my formative years and youth in Richmond, BC. So that's just, of course, south of Vancouver. And in the 80s, that was a very different small town than it is now. So now I'm going to ask you a question. I've known and watched you for a long time. And in your storied career, what's your biggest regret?
Oh, yeah, all of the things I realized I could have done on council, but either didn't have the confidence or didn't know about. So, yes, when I see things, we'll talk housing, of course. Okay. I realized, oh, my gosh, if we'd been more on top of that.
Right.
Those kind of inklings you might have had.
Sure.
Should have followed through.
Boy, I hope nobody asks me that question when I'm your age.
What's your generation?
You mean like Gen X, sort of thing? Yeah, I guess it's Gen X, but I guess I'm pretty textbook, actually. You know, I mean, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and I check all the boxes.
Feel your stereotypical Gen X, whatever that is?
As I've aged, I'm starting to feel more like a boomer. But I think so. I think so. Yeah, I think I am. And I remind myself of that. That's certainly falling into a linear... you know, definition and the silo.
Yeah, I want to know what the stereotype is.
Well, I don't know. You tell me. How would you describe my generation?
Well, it looks now like you're the one that's getting jumped over. We're going directly to millennials.
Yep.
And Gen X, well, of course, you know, Doug Copeland, kind of that slacker sort of thing, I guess.
Yeah, well.
Do you think Copeland had nailed it? He named it.
I think he certainly, yeah. I think he hit on a lot of the themes and the tropes of that era for sure. And I, you know, when I think of what my generation has done, we raised the millennials. There's lots of regrets. Speaking of regrets, I think a lot of people my age go, oh my goodness, maybe we kind of blew it. We're you know, and there's some social issues that can be directly tied not only to your generation but certainly to mine.
Oh, let's find our way back there. But give me a question.
Sure. Are you ever going to actually retire?
Well, if you mean by retirement,
but you're still so vibrant and active in the work that you do, the passionate work in the urban space. Is
active
that...
is the key.
Yep.
Yeah. So a big mistake, is to go into retirement not having some intent, a focus, something that is going to make keep you active.
Yeah. So your activity is keeping you vibrant, and you're still an important voice in this conversation.
That's sweet.
In our city.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons for the podcast.
Right. Of course.
What a great opportunity to talk with many of the people that I've known over the years, tell their stories too.
Right.
Yeah, boomer stories. The generation that shaped this place. Now being succeeded by, well, the millennials. Yeah. We are jumping over the Gen X. What would be, do you think, in your career, what you're going to point back to and say, whoa, I'm proud of that?
I would probably say it wouldn't. Oh, this is going to sting a little bit. You know, for 20 years, I ran my own design firm that was a brand, identity, strategy, communications, and media sort of firm that specialized in telling other corporate for-profit stories often. And over the years, increasingly, that became less rewarding, less meaningful, and it's not something. I mean, I'm proud of the work, and I'm proud of being a creative professional, and all of that. But even in the last few years, since taking on a different role with what was one of my clients, a social impact oriented design and architecture firm, that work has been really compelling, challenging, rewarding, and I think I'm going to invariably be looking back and saying that was it. That's when I started to hit
your proudest moment is yeah, still to unfold.
I think it's still coming. Yeah, I think I'm now on track to really be a part of a team that changes the conversation and the world.
In fact, are you a storyteller? Is that?
Gosh, you know that rubs me the wrong way. But to deny that would be disingenuous.
Why does it rub you the wrong way?
Because I think it's been so overused. It's quite ubiquitous. People use storytelling. There's lots of terms that rub me the wrong way. I'm just being honest. That one seems like it's been used a lot by folks. But absolutely, a key part of what I do is look for patterns and opportunity and the human narrative and the story arc and the hook and the call to action and how to translate and convert a problem, a challenge, an opportunity into a solution and innovation. And so storytelling is a big part of it. It's a big part of what I do at work.
I wonder if it's partly explaining,
mm-hmm.
given the narrative, there's yep. another overused word,
yep.
but also getting others to articulate themselves what it is that they think, they see, they
well,
want.
Well, okay. Yes. You've hit on something really important that I find I do daily. And that is, I am, you and I both share a personality trait that we're slightly, maybe you're less slightly than me, contrarian, right? We like to debate. Discourse and disagreement is actually at the core of the love we have for each other and the world at large, that I don't have to agree with everybody. But that also comes into play when you're a strategist and when you're, as you say, a storyteller, and certainly when you're trying to, as I am, trying to inspire folks who might be entrenched in traditions and practices and behaviors that may not be producing the sort of impact and innovation that one could hope for in the world. Like, I'll give you an example. Designers, and I'm not a licensed architect, so I'm not going to speak on behalf of our architects, but architects broadly, if I'm painting with a broad brush, haven't had the positive impact on the world that they could have, but yet still possess the opportunity to do so. So I'm part of a team and working with this beautiful, beautiful design organization that imagines a future where everything we do.
Who is this?
Our firm is called HCMA Architecture and Design.
Got to get the plug in.
I don't want a plug. This is not self-promotion. But but you asked a great question, because part of my storytelling role, I think, and when I'm referring to that contrarian thing, is I will constantly challenge my colleagues, both in the firm and in the industry, our clients, their users, to define things like values and beliefs, shared beliefs, and the principles that guide their behavior and their goals, and constantly striving to use story and to use language and to hosting and conversation, even slipping towards discourse, frankly, to get clarity on where we can really maximize our impact.
I am so struck by what you just said, though, that you felt designers, licensed designers, in a sense, haven't fulfilled their potential. They haven't. How did you phrase it?
Well, okay. So if I'm bold, I mean, I don't want to use hyperbole and be dramatic, which is my want sometimes. But absolutely, we have underdelivered in our potential. I really don't think that. This is Western Canada, but I have served as an executive in the design associations and traveled the world. I've seen this all over the place. I do not think that architecture and the AEC, the architecture, engineering, and construction industry, has modernized and is innovating and is prioritizing the social need, the real lived experience of human beings at the core of what they do, and taken steps to step away from the risk-averse traditions of best practices that fall under licensure and what have you, to really bravely experiment and boldly dip into new ways of being and trying to push this forward. And as a result, of course, government, all layers of government, aren't fully aware of what we as designers can do in the world because we haven't done a great job of communicating it up to them or being a good lived example of the potential of
in their design. Defense. Is it because...
Says the ex-politician.
Is that because... they can't take that amount of risk, that degree of risk, in such a professional and competitive environment.
That is every day. Not every day, but I am often reminded that at the end of the day, I do work for a licensed for-profit architecture firm that serves the public safety.
And
first.
You don't have a license. You've got the freedom.
I get to do so, and we are envisioning a new form of design firm that is transdisciplinary, and part of who we are definitely is. The architecture practice, that I am not an architect, but I participate in these projects. But we need to go beyond that and think bigger.
How big is the firm?
We're about 100 staff. Yeah, offices here and in Victoria.
Give us some sense of how that rates in the architectural firmament in terms of its size.
It's in Vancouver. That's a mid to large size firm. It's large. And it's a... you know, we've had lots of opportunities to grow even bigger, and there are, and you can imagine what that might look like.
Well,
and
we're not exactly what's happening
we're not everywhere. Yes, but we're not particularly interested in just becoming part of a big machine. We're interested in producing big results. And
so
if that means going our own path, we're going our own path.
How are your results going to be different because you've added this value component?
Well, you mean long term? Well,
not even short term projects.
Yep. So we do. Our firm and really focuses on community oriented social spaces.
Yeah, I wondered about that.
Pools and schools and community centers and public domains and ice rinks and city safety buildings and these sort of spaces. And as a result, we're really keen to find out how we can engage with public and do an active research and learning prior to the assignment, right? So that we'd really understand what's unique about a community, a neighborhood, a city, an area, whatever, and apply new forms of interdisciplinarity to how we show up in that
process.
Are
you the front man? Are you the guy who goes out there and interacts?
Yep, absolutely part of that. Process designing, service design, facilitation, engagement, customer and stakeholder engagement. We have a team of us. I'm part of that team, absolutely. And then also on the back end, it's unfortunate to say, but I can't lie, very few architecture firms and design firms that have the opportunity to do what we do for people literally go back and ask those people later, like what's called post-occupancy evaluation, and analyze how well things went. That is actually a rarity, which is shocking to me still and disappointing, and we're not having it. Like, we're just not having it. We've created a social sustainability framework, and we're investing our own time and energy. If our clients can't afford to pay us, we're going to fund a research initiative to make sure that if we make design choices to provide true inclusivity to a space, or so that you have agency to feel over your domain, or that you feel connected to others, or delighted by the space, or happy. What is happy? We want to find out what we did and in what fashion, so that we can go back and say, okay, next time, if this is a priority for this community, these are the steps we're going to make.
How long have you been doing that?
We're a few years into that. This year we are going to release our social sustainability framework to the wild. So we will open source that. There are very few firms that have done such a thing. And so I think we'll be working on this, honestly, Gord, for the next decade. This will be an evolving practice for the next 10 years of forever, right? Like, we're never going to stop learning how to better serve mankind through creativity and design.
I'd love to get into a really good example. Is there a project, a particular project, you'd be comfortable talking about?
Sure. Yep, sure. We have lots where we've learned lessons from the West Vancouver Community Center, but at City Hall there up the... we learned lessons. There's a story that our managing partner, Daryl Condon, tells about... steps that could have been taken to have created a more inclusive space. which is, you know, honestly, that's different than accessible. It's important in design to realize that, you know, accessible is one thing, or diversity is one thing in creating spaces and crowds, but truly enabling, empowering, and inviting folks to participate and have agency in a space, that takes a certain type of environment and choices that we can make as designers. Hillcrest was a great example of a space where we really worked hard, the team, to design.
Where is Hillcrest?
That's in Vancouver.
What is it?
And that is a community center. And it was built, purpose-built for the Olympics to be repurposed as a community center afterwards. And it is thriving. In fact, one of the lessons in hindsight with that space is that we could have even made it bigger. Like, it is packed, that place, right?
When you talk about the community, the public.
Yeah.
There's kind of a big difference between West Vancouver and Hillcrest.
This is why I'm offering different perspectives. There's different context to create bespoke approaches design-wise. One that we're working on right now that is fantastic, and I got to participate in the engagement and the strategy part of, was with our terrific client, the city of Surrey, that city is growing and growing and growing and can't keep up with school construction and community centers and galleries, and we've done a lot of this work. There's one community called Clayton Heights, usually it's referred to, they hired our firm to design on a particular plot of land, a library to service this community, an arts center, and a recreation center. Three different bespoke buildings, three different bespoke programs, three different unique expressions of governance and oversight and how you manage these, and also three different, very different cultures. Okay? After our process, after challenging them.
Three different cultures.
The sports and rec culture, those people that show up, run that place, participate in that space, are very different than those who are going to for a pottery class at a rec or an art center, or very different yet again in terms of the attitudes and the needs and expectations from someone going to a library. What's a library? So we challenged them, and they were very open and receptive to a new approach front end to reconceiving how design could challenge what could maximize what that community wanted. We went to the community. We talked about this. And what was resonant and quite clear in that conversation was, we need a hub. We need a place we need a giant third living room. We need a place where we can bump into, loiter, linger, love each other, and that's not going to happen with the library in that corner and the art center in that corner, and it's a missed opportunity. Also, we challenged them to think about the sustainability options, environmentally and cost-wise, to create one, and this is ultimately what has happened. It is now mid-construction, and it's looking gorgeous. One combined facility that shares one giant flexible space where athletics and recreation are right there, highly visible, arts are right there, libraries right there, and all three teams are one hybrid team. Can you imagine? Like the librarian and the sports dude and the artsy fartsy sitting at the same counter at check-in? That is literally what this space is. And it is first of its kind, and the whole building's built to passive standards.
Whether it's the first of its kind. This sounds like Britannia Community Center, which had much the same ideals in the 70s.
That's exactly. Britannia came up as an exemplar, actually. But those are separate buildings with separate HVACs and separate footprints and separate entrances and separate everything. This is one big passive house, high performance, beautiful building with a gorgeous staircase in the middle, and it'll host long table dinners and yoga classes and community events, and this is a complete game changer.
Okay.
And it's the only one of its kind that we can find in North America.
When we post this podcast, I'd love to put some pictures and
let's do that. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I want to go back to something else. It seems to me that Clayton is just such a great place to be experimenting at this scale, since East Clayton itself is an experiment.
That's right.
Tried to create it higher density, still something that meets suburban taste, but doing it in a way much more sustainable.
Have you been there?
Yeah.
Have you looked at that housing?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Okay. And more interestingly, the parking.
Ugh.
It was meant to not have as much demand for parking. Did not turn out that way.
Did not work out that way.
People will say because there isn't transit, et cetera.
That's right.
But okay, at least they tried.
Oh, and I'll give them credit for that. And that's one of the things that a city as busy and growing as Surrey has the luxury of, and privilege to be able to do. They can start to try these things out.
It's good to hear they are.
They are.
But I'm also
I don't know anymore.
good point. Mayor. We'll see. We'll watch that. I'm also struck, though, by the challenge you had of meeting the communities.
Yes.
Various prescribed needs.
Yes.
Ice rinks and library yes. and pottery.
Which prescribed is the key word because those come with programmatic
yeah.
expectations that are often not even challenged.
Well,
this is how many square footage you get. This is what you do.
You wanted to provide a correct. Place of serendipity
That's
for
right.
interaction.
That's right.
For that kind of intangible way that people meet.
That's right.
Wow.
Yep. And now we have carried that forward into other projects.
You won't know if that works until you see it.
That's right.
But did it work in West End?
It did. Tremendously. High success on that project and it's carried through multiples. And in fact, right now in North Vancouver, we're designing the entire new Harry Jerome Community Center and Aquatic Center and Senior Center. That is a giant complex. I think it's the largest municipal project under construction in the province.
What's the special sauce of serendipity?
Well, it's
getting people just interact.
There's a mix of a number of things. I'm sure, and I'm not an expert, so I'll right off the bat say I don't know for sure, and none of us really do. But we are definitely trying to find ways to bring the expertise and the learnings about what health and happiness, the relationship between health and happiness and social sustainable stuff, how that pairs with environmental sustainability. In fact, we've done something I think is quite interesting and unusual. And let me know if I'm if you know of any examples of this. But we've merged our technical environmental sustainability team, right? And they're all about carbon and energy loss and the technologies of construction in that sense. And our social sustainability research team, they're now one team because we don't see them. Why are those different? Why aren't how you feel in your body and your mood and your family and your community also tied completely with how the buildings perform, how the environment that you are in operates? So we've combined those things. That's interesting. So we bring that expertise and the learnings that come with that research into a conversation that front loads prior to programming and make sure that we can test our hypotheses, some of which is very sort of like Steve Jobs used to say, the people don't know what they want, I'll tell them what they want. So part of that, which has been historically one of the things that architecture and the entire broad spectrum of design industry has been criticized for not actually listening, not just, we just tell, right? We show up, we have all the answers, we'll just, here's what we're gonna do. We're not doing that anymore. We're engaging in deep conversations to establish clarity.
Is that what Gen X actually has given? I'm thinking a lot of what you said sounds like the things that I remember being yeah. discussed so much in the 90s and 2000s.
Yep.
The sense of listening,
yep.
of values,
mm-hmm.
along with the technical expertise.
Yep.
And they set what the needs were and the goals.
Yep.
What I'm trying to get to is we're in the millennium age now.
Yep.
Where are the deliverables? Have we actually, isn't it your job, to find out whether those values the Gen X set have actually had a practical way of being implemented?
Of course it is. Of course. My bet would be if this was...
I want to know, Mark. I want some tangible indications, whether it's in design or in the success, that you're able to actually bring people together in a serendipitous way while still at the same time meeting all their needs.
Yeah, well, one of the things I've seen millennials bring to the conversation is a bit of radical open-mindedness that is a little, your gen and mine, we had it all figured out, right? Like we had, you know, I mean, we're the experts, we're the wise.
I don't agree with that.
Well, I think
the reverse, in fact. Gen X was questioning the kind of lockstep.
Okay, but the point, okay, I'll restate. What I mean is, if my generation liked to talk about progressive issues and liked to talk about conversation and liked to talk to people a lot, the millennials are showing up going, okay, let's get on with it.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. So when we're bringing them to conversations about the potential of space, the potential of design, they're like, oh, stop it. There's a climate emergency happening. Oh, cut it out. Who cares if we have to raise taxes? Let's invest in these things.
Did you literally hear that?
Yeah, oh, yeah, sure.
That we have a climate emergency going on?
Oh, sure. They're an intolerant. They're, in fact, you know, what I also hear, which is really a shame, and it's not consistent. I don't know if you can tell me what your experience has been. Yeah. You speak to all young people all the time. Right. But I hear, when we're in dialogue, I hear almost equal parts anxiety over the state of the world and politics and their future and careers and, oh my God, robots are going to take my jobs. And all of this stuff that they're just like absolutely consumed with anxiety. A lot would to do with, I imagine, because they have a constant barrage of always on bad news media hitting all the time and narcissism and shallow bullshit that permeates their reality. So that's on one side. But on the other side, a yearning to get involved, an eagerness to bravely take chances, no fear, very entrepreneurial perspective on risk taking. And as that permeates our own staff and the culture of our team of 100 design minds, now we have young people going, why? Why does it have to be that way? Let's do it this way. Like, why? I'm sorry. That's the way it's been done 1,000 times before. Why are we doing it the same way? Clearly it's not working. Let's go deeper. Let's try something new. And so that's the space. I love that. And I'm accountable for something we do at our firm called Tilt Curiosity Labs, which we can talk about. It's a cluster of creativity experiments and explorations and collaborations and investments. But our staff resonate in that space where it's like the young ones, the millennials especially.
Let's put a gender lens on it. Yep. Do you see a difference or a similarity between young men and women now?
A gender lens. Well, I mean, my firm is more female than male, which is unusual. It's a male-dominated business. We have female partners, even. That's, I'm proud of that. We work quite a bit. I'm a overeducated, privileged, straight, white, 50-year-old male. I mean, I'm the part of the problem, right? But that also means I'm part of the power paradigm that can actually make choices to make space and room and include those voices. So I try to do so. When we have conversations with folks that have influence and opinions in that millennial space, I don't think I could tell you that either gender is a louder voice than the other, except that I just heard my own brain say, that's not true, Mark. And I think women are emerging as a more thoughtful, a more engaged, and a far more powerful voice than in my entire lifetime than I've ever heard before. And I speak at design schools. I'm on advisory boards for design schools. I'm constantly amongst young people, and I'm surprised, but I'm getting used to it, how dominant the female gender is in that space, or rather just the non-male identified gender.
Well, and men's attitude and interaction with women. That has changed by generation.
It's getting better. It's certainly getting better. I feel like feminism is no longer as misunderstood or as rare as it was, you know, when it first, you know, it took a long time before I identified as a feminist. And now I feel like the millennials, most millennials, certainly in this sort of context, in the urban, I don't know elsewhere, but I can speak to my own experiences, are far more feminist oriented in the way they show up and their attitudes than ever before.
So when you are working on a project,
yep,
that's put you back in the role of the front man,
yep,
engage with the community, your job is to listen and find, yep, out what their values, yep, and needs are.
And challenge, and right, ask questions, and facilitate, yep.
I'm still amused by the idea of going into West Vancouver, mm-hmm, one day, and into Surrey the next.
Yep.
Don't you also...
And Montreal, and Toronto, oh, and Regina, yeah, and Calgary, and, you know, like, we all these communities have different... And this, we're doing a ton of work in the Squamish Nation.
How
so
quickly
it's all different.
Do you size up the group that you're going to be dealing with? Do you have a way of measuring, in a sense, who they are?
Well, as a process designer, I take very seriously the 80% of the work required to host a workshop or a session or an engagement before the event. It only... During the event and after, that's only 20% of the work. And part of that thinking and planning and investigation is that. And so, for instance, one of the things that I really appreciate as a tactic, is finding a way to create a compelling invitation. And by invitation, I don't mean, hey, Gordon, come to this workshop, this open house, so we can talk to you. More like, hey, Gordon, who has been carefully chosen and identified amongst a broad spectrum of folks to represent the population. Here's a survey where I ask you what the opportunities are with this project, and what the challenges are as from your perception, or what your greatest day might be in your imagined future, or what question should I, literally we ask that question, what questions do you think I should be asking you? And we do those anonymously, and at least 3 days, sometimes a week before an event, so that we get those, we can analyze that data. You show up, people who come to our sessions show up already kind of aware of what we're going to be talking about, having noodled on it for at least 72 hours. And then often, which is amazing, we pull the three rogue answers from those that data, which have no name associated, and put them up to start conversation. Boom, we got it. We own them. Like, they're there.
Mark, here's what I'm trying to get to.
Okay.
Everyone, I do, you do, talks about the community.
The community.
And I think we have a hope, an aspiration that we are indeed a community.
Right.
There's things that bring us all together so that we can use the collective noun.
But I also feel like I belong to different communities,
yeah,
right? Like
well, this ones. Is what I think the reality is. Yep. Surely someone who's lived here, like us, maybe 50, 60, 70 years, privileged and affluent, West Vancouver, high sense of entitlement. And then you go to, well, let's go to Surrey, where most of the immigrants are arriving. They may not have been here for more than half a year, and in a culture that we can't see.
Right.
Can you fairly call that a community, from West Vancouver?
Well, I'm going to tip my hippie hat here a little bit. You know, for me personally, doing this work, I subscribe, and it's important to understand that lens. Like I approach this work with the belief that actually the planet is one organism, and we're all deeply connected to each other and to it. And so I don't you can't start a conversation with that. But to frame how you go into a conversation by acknowledging the unique idiosyncrasies of this particular place and respecting the identity that has been pervasive in a place as you enter, but then offer some. And our job as designers is to make sure that we're not preaching, we're not insisting, but we're showing opportunities for a better approach. There's a better way we can show up for each other. There's a better way that we can design for each other. There's a better way we can build environments that we can thrive in. And you're right. That's very different, but you know, like from one community to another. But that's and I'm not dismissing what you're saying, Gordon, but that's the fun. That's the opportunity.
Well, it must
that's where
be.
That's what you have. That's what we have to do better.
You must have an underlying confidence.
We do.
That you can design for the creation of the community.
That's right.
You still believe.
That's right.
That at least in this place, Metro Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, we can do that.
That's right. We do.
In a disruptive age of identity politics.
That's right.
And divisions
where universal bathrooms and pools have to have Muslim female swim day, and all that stuff can coexist with the fact that you can still be that identity that you – they're not incompatible. Where some will never, ever agree. Some, you know, like I my mind goes to the single-family homes that dominate the west side of our city. Those folks just don't – you know, that's the strong NIMBY identity – thing, and that's going to be a difficult conversation to have about the advantages to think of a new approach to that sort of density and design approach to city building. But we have to do it. We have to go in and we have to respectfully see where they're coming from. Don't discount it. Can't discount it, but challenge them to think beyond and experiment. You know, try, show them. And we have been, I think the city has been doing actually some pretty interesting things where we have actually shown some folks who have changed their minds that there is a different way, and we're not going to be ruined if we put affordable housing in down the block.
We're sure going to need more of you. I'll tell you why. Don't you get the sense that we've reached a tipping point?
Say more.
As far as, let's use the west side, it covers most of Vancouver, the single family.
We've got to stop those.
Well, that stopped quite a while ago.
I know.
Now it's the major change to their scale and character.
Yep.
And I think you're right. You just can't go in there
wholesale and wipe out.
But we kind of are ready to do that.
You mean the insertion of sort of high density?
There seems to be at least generationally,
like the corridor approach. Is that what you mean?
No, much bigger. Look, I do understand because I grew up in it. The attraction of what this culture created in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Let's be specific, the
garden suburb.
Did you grow up in a single family home?
Yeah.
Big backyard, the whole deal.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. No.
Did you?
No. It was the norm. It was the expectation.
Yeah.
Just as 99% of everyone around you looked more or less like you.
Yeah.
And you were sharing a common political and indeed the sense of being on the edge of the wilderness in an incredibly beautiful place, culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in the 70s, we deliberately, of course, as a matter of policy, opened it up to the world.
Yep.
And here it is.
Here we are.
Can we still maintain that sense of wonder and value and privilege that we had in the communities that we built, if we're really going to change their scale and character? Is that worth losing?
Yeah, I'm not going to answer that question. Right.
It's an observation.
Yeah,
but it does seem to me you're the kind of guy who's going to have to go in there and be part of the assistance of how that change is going to occur.
This is my belief. I'll put my cards on the table. I believe the future of humanity behooves us to cluster in intelligent ways in high density urban settings.
Describe. Give me.
The planet cannot stand suburbia.
I want a description of what it looks like. Does it look like where we are now?
No.
And we better describe that. It's one.
Do you mean the way the city is expressed now?
We are in, describe where we are here. We're at Mark's home.
Yep, we're inside. We're sitting at my dining room table.
And what's the neighborhood it's in?
We're in Mount Pleasant.
Wait, part of Mount Pleasant?
We're on the edge of Mount Pleasant, facing the edge of False Creek Flats.
We're about a block from Emily Carr.
Right, that's right.
Great Northern Way is running by us.
We're in a 1,400 and something square foot loft with 18-foot ceilings with, giant... I mean, it's
four
very...
Four five stories?
This is a five stories.
Looks industrial.
Looks... It's definitely industrial. It's an IC3 zoned live-work...
Which we did. I was on council at the time, and it was something experimental.
You,
it was risk-taking, but...
Some people loved it, some people hated it.
Is this what you mean by intelligent density?
I think this is intelligent density.
We could do more of this.
Correct.
This would work in other parts of Vancouver.
I would love to see this kind of density... More of this throughout the city. I think that the tower, where there's such a challenge to connect those people to a sense of place, and we don't spend enough because we don't have a lot of land, so it's difficult design. It's not impossible. We've done it. I've seen others do it, but creating connections, visceral connections, with convening and gathering places and spots in that concept is limited and has been challenging in this city. But like this, for instance, on this building, the top floor is only half lofts. The front is an entire huge shared deck, gardens, barbecues, picnic tables. It's unbelievably gorgeous. And so this, and I can go to any floor in this building. I can get off at any floor. I don't need a fob to get on third floor and knock on someone's door and ask for a cup of sugar. My friends who live downtown cannot do that. And they have no garden to go. Some of them do. Some of these buildings have the podium with a little bit of shared space. We need much more of that. Much more of that.
So we're looking at something that you'd find typically in a northern European city.
That's
Germany,
right.
Stockholm, some places like that. Okay. If we take this model into the single-family neighborhoods, it means fundamentally changing their scale and hence their character. Agreed?
Yes.
So we're talking the end of that neighborhood. Yes. It's the equivalent of sending in bulldozers.
Sorry, Grandma. Yes. Over time, not tomorrow, but I think that it can start to encroach on that. And over time, some of these homes, I also think Gordon and our team is very interested in this. We are, by the way, we're building right now. This is not normally our thing, but we're building a large luxurious home in the West Side, in a very upscale neighborhood that is actually Living Building Challenge. It'll be Vancouver's first, which is shocking because that has all kinds of implications. You can Google what Living Building Challenge means, but there is a better way to design from a sustainability and design aesthetic perspective, single family homes still. But some of these homes, especially these big monster houses, the fact that there's one or two people living in these houses, that has got, we have got to challenge that expectation. And that's the
well, this is the time that we're in. The challenge is underway.
It's happening.
Now, it does seem to me to be saying without being explicit that we're going to basically not follow the grand bargain that we've had in this region since the 1950s.
Yeah.
Burnaby's the best expression of it. In the 70s, they had a plan for apartment districts.
God, Burnaby.
And the understanding was that they would not encroach, as you were suggesting, into the single-family home areas.
Yeah, look what they've done.
Yeah, the metro towns, the Brentwoods, along the SkyTrain lines. From a transit point of view, it's been fabulously successful.
Sure it has.
It's concentrated the density, and it's kept intact the single-family neighborhoods.
Yep.
The same thing happened in the 60s here. We have the West End, Carisdale. West Vancouver has it in Ambleside, Lower Lonsdale.
But Gordon, the conversation we're having...
You want to break that bargain and encroach into those neighborhoods and disrupt the bargain.
Sure. But we're talking about something that through the lens of a 25-year window. So now I say, let's have a conversation through the lens of 100 years. Like, are we going to make it? Is our species going to make it? Then we have to start making bolder, grander design moves towards bringing people together in clusters and densifying. And we're not going to create, you know, the potential aspirational society of tomorrow if all we do is jam people into a little cluster so that we can protect grandpa in his backyard.
What about not protecting grandpa, but protecting the people who value what those neighborhoods mean and what they are?
Sure.
And we'll articulate those reasons and fight hard to save them. Patrick Condon School, right?
Yeah.
Don't bring in SkyTrain.
Yeah, I know.
It will destroy the scale and character.
Yeah, Patrick.
And those neighborhoods handle high density, and they do it in a sustainable way. And they're our heritage.
Doesn't he want to put a trolley car down Broadway or something?
Well, kind of the metaphorical equivalent.
Yeah. Ding, ding.
Right. If we're going to build in the way that you say you don't like, which is clustering density around SkyTrain stations.
Many have studied this.
That's alternative.
Unless I'm mistaken, I love the provocation, and this is a great dialogue, typical of what you and I talk about. But there's science. You've heard of science, yes? There's evidence, there's data that says people living in close proximity and sharing and touching skin on skin produces happier and healthier human beings. When you put people into rows of fenced in little get out of my backyard private enclaves, we're not offering, that was and remains a particular design choice of living that I think has, for the most part, been proven to be less effective in many ways.
Let's go into a kindergarten.
There's going to be families who definitely, you know, 8 kids need to live in a house and have a backyard. That's fine. Those are going to happen, right? But
let's go into a kindergarten and ask the children there to draw a home.
Yes.
What do you think they draw?
These days, I'm not sure. It's my age. Certainly, it would be the little triangle house with the chimney and the tree in the backyard with the swing, and that was what I grew up with, right? That was hell. I came from Manitoba where we had fields. But now I wonder if I don't even know what, like Adrian Crook, what would his kids draw? A little square with all the little kids in it? I don't know. That it's definitely changed.
I think we'll ask Adrian to do that. We'll post the results on when we do this podcast.
Kids, like,
oh, that's such a great
home.
Idea.
What would they, because they live all together in an apartment.
So did you grow up in it? Oh, you seem to turn out okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it all that bad?
Well, you know, looking back, growing up in a big house with a big yard with the garage and yada yada and all those things that it afforded me, trees to climb, back alley to jump my bike over ramps and all of those things, which were all great. They're all great memories or whatever. I'm certainly grateful I live in this type of situation now, where my yard is that little garden strip outside there, and my yard is a shared park where I sit on a beautiful evening with views of the mountains and having barbecue and a picnic table with 20 of my neighbors. I prefer it. I think it's a superior existence. And I feel like I belong. I feel like people have my back. I feel like if the shit goes down and the zombie apocalypse happens, I'm in a good place.
You live in a community.
I do. I live in a community. And this is the type of ideology and philosophy that we wish to bring to as many of our clients that pay us to design and to challenge them and say, we're not going to go all the way there now, but is there a better way that we can get you to think outside of the standard conventions of this is what community looks like, this is how housing shows up, you know what I mean?
Let's talk the client as the city. City of Vancouver. Yep. Council's got to decide whether in the city plan process,
yep,
this is going to be...
Even the citywide plan?
Neighborhood, yeah. Whether it's going to be citywide.
Right.
We're going to start with our yep, basic values and yep, our policies. And then we're going to say to everyone,
yep,
every neighborhood, here now is what we expect in order to achieve what right, we've agreed on is a good thing and more survivable.
Right.
You have to respond to that.
Right.
Or, on the other hand, neighborhoods know best. We're not going to start with those premises that they have to change and accept a certain amount of density or
right,
prescribed notions of what we think is best.
Yeah, but see, this is interesting.
What would you choose?
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah, I don't know. Like, here's when I hear talk of, and I have spoken with politicians and urban and planners galore about this situation. And you know, the thing for me, bear in mind, I'm a branding, strategy, identity, communications guy, and I when I think citywide plan, I think what is the identity, personality, shared beliefs, attitudes, feelings, what is the expression of Vancouver's very best self in the future?
Oh, I want specifics.
Well, that's what, well, no, it is, I'm not going to answer
you're
it for
that's my, what you're, that's, okay,
when
I got
you
that,
say
but
city
I wrote
plan,
the question.
When you say city plan, when you say what's our city plan, how is endless conversations about zoning and bylaws and that stuff, how do you map, that's a difficult, it's work that needs to be done.
All right.
This is work that needs to be done. But we need to understand, like, do we want to be a friendly city or an unfriendly city?
So you persuaded me that this form of development, four
yeah,
or five stories,
yep,
features that you've talked about, is healthier and more sustainable.
Okay.
All right. And now you're going to go out in the community and you're looking for, quote, you know, their values.
Mm-hmm.
But you still have to make a decision whether you're going to accept that they would like pretty much to the status quo, only better.
Well, yeah.
But retaining effectively their scale and character.
Right.
Or, no, that issue's been settled. We're changing.
Yeah. Having facilitated large scale and participated in large scale community engagement initiatives, including recently the False Creek Flats arterial community panel as a facilitator on that, my goodness, the balance between empowering public to have agency over making those decisions and deeply respecting the entrenched historical yeah, kind of identity of place versus, hey, we're your elected officials, we're the hired to do that, we're the experts, we're going to tell you what needs to be done. The balance between those two things is the challenge. There's no easy way to do it. It just needs to be done. But, you know, this conundrum... It is a conundrum. It's the conundrum of democracy. And of course, democracy's unraveling before our eyes, so this may not last long anyway. Once we get to fascism, and it will be great. We just do whatever we want. But anyway, the conundrum is actually why I'm not sure that I would ever make a decent politician, because I am torn. I have a
You're
deep,
Gen X.
I have a
You're
deep,
Gen X. You framed
yep,
the conundrum.
I know. I know we did.
And the millennials?
I know.
Want an answer.
They just want to get on with it. And I want to have conversation. I want to build community. I want to actively listen and respect and have thoughtful disagreement with people and then turn around and I want to go, the data is clear. We hear you, but here's what needs to be done. And, you know, people are going to always have complaints and gosh, we're good at whinging in this city. And there's going to be pushback and whining. And if you please everybody, it's a problem. But I really feel like we have to just get aggressive and make some decisions. And to some extent, although, you know, I have mixed feelings about the current council in City Hall, there is some of that happening. They're like, we're going to make some bold moves. There is some of that. And I'm kind of, some of the stuff baffles me, but some of it I'm really impressed with.
What I'm wondering is whether, I'm pretty sure you believe that once we've made some tough decisions, we will collectively accept them.
Yep. I hope so. Right. I think so.
Yeah.
So we're Canadians.
I was just going to say.
Yeah.
But I wonder if in the world that we are actually in,
yeah,
when there's so many, simply because we're bigger as a place, so many new ways of identifying and creating or being part of your own community, that maybe the supposition is wrong.
The supposition that we can...
That we'll all collectively accept
this. Yeah, well,
making,
I mean,
the tough decisions to change.
Well, therein lies the downfall of humanity.
Whoa.
I mean, if we can't find ways to let each of us have a bit of our own the way we need to be while working together for a common good,
So what do you see?
That's where the hope lies.
What do you see out in Surrey? I'm thinking particularly if there's a place to watch where there are ability to
Surrey.
Maintain a sense of, quote, Canadian community, let's call it that, because it's clearly we've made the decision. We have become multicultural.
Oh, yeah, especially in Surrey.
Do you see the ability to create a community out of all of that? And do you see it in action?
I do. We've produced a number of projects in Surrey that are, like, you know, in 2016, the best built sports facility in the world, planet, according to World Architecture Festival, was the Grandview Heights Aquatic Center. We designed that. We built that with consultation with the city and pushed boundaries and innovation. Beautiful design. That is such a successful place for a lot of reasons that can be mapped to the design choices that were made. And a lot of, you know,
Does everybody in the community, and I mean pretty much everybody, all different groups find common space.
I would say maybe one of the complaints that have come in the post-occupancy evaluation in that space is perhaps not as much of the competitive swim capacity that they would have wanted to, you know what I mean? But that's going to happen. Again, that's another kind of community. There's pockets of community inside of community, and everyone's going to have demands. We're currently working on the new Westminster new pool and community center. Same thing. We have to balance the needs of the, I think they're called the HIACs or there's a competitive swim organization there that's very loud and powerful. And then there's a community, and they want a place where they can, you know, have their own hub and their own space and their own social needs and have that serve broader than 50 lane pools with warm up and warm down cool
story
down
time.
Tanks. And go.
So when the West End Community Center was being designed in the 70s, it was exactly the same debate. If we built a regulation scale skating rink, it would be used heavily by people in the amateur skating community.
That's right.
And really,
and then
that's
the community
not the
would
kind
never,
of community.
Yeah, exactly.
They deliberately built it under scale.
That's right. Yeah. Well, these things happen.
But it shows you that.
Yeah.
Let's go to the other end of the community as far as at least physical scale. Let's go right downtown. Your office is at Hastings and...
We are right at Hastings and Granville.
You can go at your door.
We did it on purpose. We found right in the RBC building. Beautiful office. If anybody wants to come by and take a tour, it's amazing. We are downtown.
You walk out your door to what? Hastings and Granville.
Yep.
What do you see? Who's there? Who are we?
I see transit used a lot. People are using transit a lot. And it looks like a healthy flow of influx of people in and out. I remember not that many years ago, urban-minded folks would talk about how Vancouver had this unique sort of downtown populous core workforce. I'm not sure that that's actually held true. I think now what's happening is people are coming into the downtown core to work and leaving. That's
so
my
where do you think they do live?
Oh, you know, Port Moody, East Van, which isn't as affordable as it was when I used to live there. It used to be quite affordable. Even Richmond, I know folks who come in on the SkyTrain from Richmond, and so they're, you know, those near reach suburbs.
So do you think measuring Vancouver by looking at housing prices within its 44 square miles everything
is accurate
west of boundary.
Yeah.
Is that part of the reason why we can't get our heads around what this Could town be. Really is about? How can it be a yeah. place of no one can afford to live here?
If they're not living here.
And I look out, same as you,
yeah.
and wonder, and it just seems to me you're so right.
Yeah.
That this amazing increase we've seen in transit use.
Tons.
18% in 3 years.
And transit, I got a kudos to transit folks and the city for helping enable that because...
It's extraordinary.
It works so well.
Yeah.
I don't even drive anymore. My wife has a car. She works at UBC. She has to.
Right.
Taking transit out there is awful. Let's get that damn line built. But I can walk out the front door, catch a bus that comes every 5 minutes, and 15 minutes later, I'm sitting at my desk checking yeah. my email downtown.
Yeah.
And it's super easy.
Right.
But it's also very busy and it goes so well. I also love the fact that I live in a city where every time I'm on the bus, people getting off. So thank you, driver. I love that. No city I've ever been in. Do people thank the bus drivers? That's fantastic. Yeah. Oh, it's so great.
Okay, well, here's where I'm going with this.
Okay.
It's impossible now to talk about Vancouver as though it was self-contained.
No, yeah.
Right. Yep. We are as a consequence of the success of transit.
Yep.
This highly integrated region.
Yep.
And so affordability is relative.
Yep.
To the area that you're talking about.
Correct.
And if that area is as far as the West Coast Express and a good transit system, doesn't that really kind of explain it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It also suggests to me...
But it's not that much cheaper.
The real serendipitous space of this place that's going to make us our community
yeah.
is transit.
Yeah.
Isn't that who we really see who we are?
Absolutely.
So long as... all classes and kinds of people are using it?
Absolutely. And the creative class, not in the Richard Florida sense, you know, the creative worker that is my tribe, is who I service, it's who I host, it's who I talk to a lot when I'm doing my volunteer work, that's who I'm surrounded by. The older ones are sort of done with driving a car anyway, and the younger ones, like, why? They just view it as, like, why would you buy a car? I know millennials who don't even have the driver's license. And I love that I live in a city, in a time where that has become normal. It's not even like they don't even get mocked. It's, you know, it's like that's the norm now. And I think that's so interesting that and we have a long way to go. Things aren't perfect with our transit system. And everyone whinges. And of course, you know, a lot of the folks you were sort of defending and earlier, they want their cars and they want to drive. And that's you and I are not representative of all those voices. You and I would rather get on a bike than that. But it's that for me is part of the data set I think that supports a healthy, happy, resilient city is one where you can actually just hop out and get into, get on a bus and be downtown or a train.
You have perfectly placed yourself.
Have I? Uh-oh.
Between that older group.
Yes.
And the younger ones.
Yes. Well, I just turned 50, so I'm no longer the older young guy.
You're Gen X.
I'm the younger. Yes, I'm the younger old guy.
You know, we spent this whole hour
yep.
talking about everything except what I know you best for,
which is
creative mornings.
Well, that's just creative one, community. Yeah, but that's just one very popular thing.
I think that's great. It's been far more interesting.
If people have listened to this podcast because they saw my name on it, they already know what
right.
that is. They can Google
it. Well, I hope they've learned what I have, which is that you've perfectly placed yourself not only professionally, but as a representative of your generation. I think your ability to define issues the way you have is very much a product of that generation.
Interesting.
And it does seem to me now you're equipped to be figuring out how we're going to knit together the younger one and their expectations with us older ones. Us older, yeah.
That's an interesting observation. I still think of myself sort of, in my brain, I'm 15 years old, of course, but that's just because I'm a boy. But anyway, I haven't really spent a lot of time considering, you know, my generation, your generation, my son's generation, you know what I mean? Like, that's a good point. And I can play that role. And perhaps it's something that I need to factor into my own commitment to open-mindedness and discourse and calling people to action to get involved in the things. Because I'm tired of talking about it. I want to do shit.
I can guarantee it. You're going to do that.
I hope so.
This has been great.
Cool. Thank you for having me.
We don't get to talk with Gen X's that much.
We're out here. We haven't... We're not quite done yet.
Hey, thanks for spending the hour.
My pleasure.